In Radio, KPFT, Houston.
Go tell it on the mountain. Go talk it to the seashore. Whisper it in the breeze. Say it wherever you please. But it's a secret that needs to get out. So tell a friend that you heard it on KPFT. It's a secret that should be shouted out. From the highest overpass to the bends in the bayou, you heard it on KPFT. If it's worth hearing, if it's worth discussing, KPFT gets the word out. So tell a friend to turn on, tune in, and listen to radio for your mind. Call 713-526-5738 to sign up a friend today. Thank you for supporting KPFT Houston, listener-sponsored radio for peace.
Welcome to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. I have a guest today. We will be taking callers later, but last week's show we had a number of questions about the Rodney Reed appeal process, pending execution, why the process was working the way the process was working, and I thought, hey, you know, I know a guy who's a lawyer, and he can explain a little of this stuff to me. And he's really, I like him a lot. He's actually a moderate conservative, and we may disagree on some specific issues, but his concern as a lawyer is justice. And following his tweets and following his Facebook page, you can see how much justice means to him, not just law. And I love him for that. So, first, I just want to get sort of the voting stuff out of the way. We will be having runoff elections. Election day is December 14th. There is early voting starting on November 27th, and you can get that information at harrisvotes.com. That's for Harris County, of course. If you're outside Harris County, you can go to your various county clerks, or you can go to votetexas.gov, which I think will send you to the appropriate place, give you the options. Okay, so my guest today is T. Greg Doucette. He goes by Greg. He's an attorney in Durham, North Carolina, who focuses on criminal defense and constitutional law. He's a political conservative and former Republican. He hosts the podcast, which is pronounced Fisk 'em All. I have a link, okay? It's spelled F-S-C-K hyphen E-M space all. But if you go to thinkwingradio.com, I actually found a link for that podcast, so you can just get it there. So he hosts the podcast, Fisk 'em All, where he focuses on the week's stories involving misconduct by police, prosecutors, judges, and politicians. Greg, are you with me?
I'm here. Can you hear?
I can.
Hey there, how are you?
I can hear you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
You are such a fascinating character. I really love you. I do. I really do. One of the things that got me kind of interested when I was following your Facebook page was you had a photograph, a selfie with Elizabeth Warren.
I do.
Now, I mean, You heard my intro. I have enormous respect for what you do, how you do it, and why you do it. But of all the Democratic candidates, that would not have been the one I would have guessed. I would have guessed maybe Klobuchar, because she's kind of moderate. Well, you see, there you go. So why don't you tell us briefly why a moderate conservative, ex-registered Republican, of all the different candidates, decided the one you feel is worth your endorsement is Elizabeth Warren?
Well, I'll start with a disclosure. Actually, the first Democrat I supported was Cory Booker.
Okay.
But at this point, it doesn't look like his campaign is going to catch fire. So I'm still conservative, and that part matters. But
yeah,
the way the Republican Party has transitioned under Trump, my philosophy is you need to nuke the GOP, and then when you're done, you need to nuke the ashes. I mean, that's really where I'm at with it. So as I was looking at the candidates, I really cannot support any of the prosecutors, Klobuchar, Harris, you know, Gabbard and military police.
Why?
They're all too prosecutorial, and it seems like none of them really understand the mechanics of what happens from the policies they put into place.
Huh.
You know, I'll use Harris as an example. Several of the things she pioneered as a DA and then again as Attorney General exacerbated mass incarceration, led to a lot of people being put into jail who should not have been put into jail, and she's congenitally incapable of recognizing that. Every time someone asks her about it in a debate, she finds some way to avoid taking responsibility for policies that she pioneered.
Well, I think that in a general sense, what she says is, I was a prosecutor, I worked for the state, I followed the law, would be her argument, has been her argument, I think, in general.
Well, I think that also takes agency away from the role of being a prosecutor. You know, they talk at length when you're going through classes on it. You know, I worked briefly in the district attorney's office here in Durham, North Carolina, and they focus heavily on being what they call a, quote, minister of justice and being able to exercise your prosecutorial discretion. And that was absent a lot. I mean, what you saw, and frankly, I understand it was the time she was in, but you saw an ambitious politician using the power to throw people in jail to rise higher and higher up the electoral ranks. And that's true of a lot of prosecutors. It's not just her. You know, that's a very common thing. You know, we've had governors here in North Carolina. Our current governor, Roy Cooper, used to be a prosecutor or attorney general. So that's a normal thing. But the effects of that that we've seen, especially since the early 2000s, has been that we're locking up more and more people, even though there's not as much crime. So we're just finding reasons to lock people up, take their money and everything else. And our whole system is just really bad as far as the criminal justice system goes. So I ruled out the prosecutors. I liked Booker, but it didn't seem like he was getting anywhere. So, you know, you're looking at the top four,
right?
Biden, Buttigieg, Sanders, and Warren. Biden and Buttigieg both are very Harris-esque as far as their views on criminal justice. I mean, Joe Biden just had a statement out yesterday where he's not willing to decriminalize marijuana because he thinks it's a gateway drug.
I just saw that.
You know, I could understand that in the 90s. It's not a serious opinion today. I mean, there's been ample research by universities around the country, you know, medical folks around the country.
And I think that has to do with an age-related generational bias, which I can actually kind of empathize with. You know, it's taken me a lot to evolve.
Right. I understand that. But at the same time, you have to be willing to, you know, accept facts. And one of the issues you find in criminal justice in particular is that the facts and data that you find from actually looking at the stuff in detail runs against what we would call conventional wisdom. You know, we look at incarceration as an example. We have a very punitive prison system focusing on punishment rather than rehabilitation.
Exactly.
And yet you look at other systems. You know, Norway is an example that folks have talked about where it's very not that. It's very focused heavily on rehabilitation, something that would never fly here in America.
And just
but
let me say that if you go to my website, thinkwingradio.com, on today's blog post, I have posted significant excerpts as well as a link to the actual article to which Greg is referring, and it really is worth a read.
Yeah, and if you look at the data of it, the recidivism rate in Norway, the amount of time that people who have been in prison reoffend, is less than 20% over 2 years. Whereas you look at other spots in Europe, UK, for example, they're at 50% reoffending in 1 year. And here in North America, it's 70% within 1 year. And the main difference between those systems is that Norway invests heavily in trying to rehabilitate people because they know that almost everyone that's in prison is going to get out.
What is the title of the article? Something like we try to make prisoners into good neighbors or something like that?
Yeah. And that's what the system should be about, because that's what's going to happen here. Unless you're serving life without parole, you're going to be released at some point. So we would hope that the people leaving prison, we want to make sure they're capable of actually becoming productive members of society again.
Well, in the vein of what you're saying, the word penitentiary, which we now consider synonymous with prison, the root of that is penitence. It's actually supposed to, it was a, like a late 19th century reform movement that's supposed to actually help people repent their crimes and become better people through whatever process they thought would be effective. And we're just not there anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. So you look at what Biden has said about it. You look at what Buttigieg has said about it when asked. They default to that old school American model where it's about punishment and being punitive and really adding on to the problems that we already have. So that leaves me with Sanders and Warren. And Sanders, you know, I'm going to argue he's a little too far extreme for me. And again, I'm coming from that standpoint of still being a political conservative.
Right.
So I started looking at Warren. And one thing I love about her, regardless of the fact that I support her politically or not, is that she has actual specific plans. My ability to say I agree or disagree with her plans is because she has plans.
Right.
And they actually have meat to them, not just some vague stuff that somebody put out. Like, you go to her website, and her plans are actually thought out. And I liked where she was at on education. I graduated from a historically black college in HBCU. She's one of the few candidates to address the issues relating to HBCUs, because many of them ended up in pretty dire financial straits under President Obama. Cuts to Gear Up and TRIO and Title III and these sort of financial lifelines that they rely on. And then Trump came into office, and he had all the presidents of HBCUs get together for a photo op, but then never really followed through on doing anything for them. So the fact that Warren knows about it and has actually put together plans in place to address their challenges is significant. And frankly, if we're going to be in a situation where the government's going trillions of dollars into debt, I'd rather, you know, forgive my student loans instead of paying for tax cuts. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, I've talked about and written about the fact that the indebtedness of people coming out of college, coming out of university, whether it's with a bachelor's or a master's, in some cases, the money they spent will never be made up in enhanced income. And in other cases, what it simply does, well, in all cases, I think what it does is depress the economy. They can't form households. They can't buy homes. They defer childbearing, all the things that go into home ownership, like furniture and appliances and tchotchkes. All of that stuff is deferred if you have $150,000, you know, in student loans pending. It just, you just can't do it. That's already a home
loan. Sallie Mae or Navien or whoever is going to make sure that they get their check every month. And if they don't, they're going to come after you. So anything you do build will end up getting snatched.
Yeah, exactly. Gets garnished or whatever.
Exactly. So I liked where Warren was at on education. I liked her criminal justice platform. You know, I'm open to her other stuff, even though I'm not necessarily sold on it yet. You know, healthcare is a good example. I hate our healthcare system. I don't know what the fix is going to be. I'm apprehensive about single-payer Medicare for All, that type of thing. But what we have now is just terrible. So it's one of those things where if we're going to have a government that's terrible, which we objectively have now under President Trump, I'm fine with a government that might be less terrible and willing to experiment with some stuff that normally I wouldn't be comfortable with, but such are the times that we're in.
Now, let me ask you. Go ahead. Well,
I went to Raleigh to see her at a town hall, and I was impressed. I mean, she was not – you get the impression from the media coverage that she's very angry and she's standoffish or whatever. And at the rally, she's not like that at all. I mean, she's very upbeat. You know, she spoke for about 2 hours and was very high energy throughout the whole thing. She's got more energy than Donald Trump does. And she was watching her deal with the selfie line is just surreal. To see a candidate for president stay for hours, take pictures with everybody, and to be super and cheery and happy as they're dealing with every single person, you know, thousands of people at a time, was just truly, I've never seen anything like it before.
And campaigning is a grind, so that really speaks about her dedication, her energy, the love, I guess, of what she feels she's fighting for.
Absolutely.
I guess a more interesting general question because you're a moderate conservative, if you prefer just conservative, I'll go with that. What do you get from other like-thinking people when you talk to them? I mean, do you see any of them shifting like you, or are they perplexed? Are they like, you know, I hate Trump, but I just can't vote for a Democrat? What are you hearing from like-minded people to yourself?
A lot of it is more just being dispirited in general. I don't expect them to vote for Warren. I think several of them will, just out of wanting Trump to be gone. I mean, they're not going to say it publicly because, God willing, we'll have some normalcy at some point after Trump's departure. But a lot of them are just really shocked at how bad things have gotten and how obsequious the Republican Party has been. I mean, it is a bunch of throne sniffers that are just willing to do anything possible to defend Donald Trump, and he's not a guy worth defending. You know, I will say, I expected things to be bad, but even I did not expect things to be this bad.
Yeah, I think I could agree with that.
Yeah, you'd think legislators, they're entitled to their positions by virtue of getting elected. You would think they would guard their power a little more jealously than they have been.
That's a puzzle. I mean, you have... Granted, you've got 435 members of the House, you've got 100 members of the Senate, but each branch has very special, unique powers that make it something to be feared politically, even by a president. And under Ryan, those House powers were not exercised, and under Mitchell, McConnell. Under McConnell, he's not exercising that kind of power. It's like, hey, if the president's not going to sign it, what's the point? I mean, that's just not how it's supposed to go. Younger people that don't have long-term memory, which is why I value age on that level, they think this is just the way it is. This is how they've grown up seeing it from the point of their political awareness. And this is not the way it's supposed to work.
Yeah, Congress is Article 1 for a reason, and no one seems to recognize that.
Certainly no one in Congress.
They're the first branch created by the Constitution.
Okay, let me do a quick station ID, and then we're going to get to the Rodney Reed stuff, which is really interesting and which a lot of people were curious about process last week. You're listening to KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. This is Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig. My guest is Greg Doucette, or T. Greg Doucette. I don't know why you don't bother just losing the T, but there you are. He's an attorney in Durham, North Carolina, focusing on criminal defense and constitutional law. He is a political conservative and former Republican and hosts the podcast Fisk 'Em All. Just go to my website. I have a link. I found a link for it, where he focuses on the week's stories involving misconduct by police, prosecutors, judges, and politicians, which is why I love this guy. Okay, let's talk about Rodney Reed. There were a number of callers on my show last week who were puzzled, angry, confused why an appeals court might not postpone his death sentence and why they might not consider new evidence as a mitigating factor. So, I mean, you sent me a lot of notes, which frankly I posted so people can see what you sent me. I think it's a nice synopsis, but we don't have that much time. So, How would you sum up, I mean, I appreciate it, I really did, but how would you sum up the normal appeals process? Someone is convicted in a lower court, standard criminal court, and then they want to appeal. So the question becomes, how can you appeal? What might prevent you from appealing, and what happens once you appeal if your appeal is accepted for adjudication?
Got it. So I have to start with a quick disclaimer. I am not yet licensed to practice in Texas. So what I'm telling you is federal and North Carolina based. And Texas is also a little special because y'all have a dedicated appellate branch just for criminal appeals.
Okay.
So bear all of that in mind. But normally, if you go through a trial and you get found guilty by a jury, you have a specific period of time to give notice to the government that you disagree with that result and you want to go ahead and appeal. A lot of places, it's only 10 days. A lot of times, you will actually see appeals announced in open court after the jury is excused, after they've returned their verdict. At that point, that starts a set of things that have to be done to what's called perfect the appeal. These are procedural things that have to be finished, and if they're not, the appeal gets dismissed automatically because you didn't go through all the paperwork. So there will be a notice of appeal that gets filed. there will be a preparation of what is called the record on appeal, which is basically all of the filed legal documents plus transcripts of the hearings. In criminal trials, what you'll see is most of the time everything will be recorded. So you will have jury selection recorded, opening statements, you know, direct and crosses of all the witnesses, objections with the judge and what it says, closing arguments and the jury verdict and the sentencing. All of that ends up in written form in a transcript, a lot of times spanning hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of pages. Once that record is complete, that gets filed with the appellate court, and then the defendant's attorney, the person filing the appeal, will then prepare a brief where they're trying to point out specific errors that took place at the trial level for the appellate court to either vacate the sentence and give them a new trial, or for certain things, actually have the verdict completely ended entirely so that you don't get a new trial, you're just acquitted at the appellate level.
What a layperson consolidates simply as grounds for appeal.
Right, exactly. So to give you some examples, if the document that was used to charge you, the indictment, if for some reason that is defective, a lot of times that will be what's called a lack of jurisdiction over the defendant, because if you don't have a proper, if you don't have the right paperwork to prosecute somebody, you can't convict them. And if that doesn't get noticed until after you're already convicted, that's something the appellate court can point to say, all right, do this all over again. You'll also see a lot of times allegations that there are procedural errors. So if the defense attorney objects to evidence at trial, but the judge allows it in and shouldn't have, that will be pointed to as a basis to try and have the verdict vacated. A lot of times you'll also see if jurors are given bad jury instruction. So, for example, most states have what are called PJIs, pattern jury instructions, that cover most offenses. They lay out, you know, explaining what the burden of proof is, explaining what the elements of a given crime are, what each of those elements means. And these PJIs are usually written collaboratively between prosecutors, defense attorneys, judges, legal scholars from the law schools, and they're refined and honed over time, and there are usually hundreds of them, but you have thousands of laws.
And
so you often have
and basically what the, and basically the principle there is to eliminate judicial variance so that you have
correct.
A consistent process.
Absolutely, that's correct. But since you have so many more crimes than you do jury instructions, you will occasionally have situations where there is no PJI for a given offense, and the lawyers and judge try to craft one that they think, you know, fits with what the past cases have decided in that given state. And sometimes they screw that up. You know, so you'll occasionally see people say, hey, you need to go ahead and give me a new trial because this particular jury instruction was bad. And if there's a bad jury instruction, it's assumed that the jury's verdict was going to be tainted and you need to do it over again. And then you have more basic stuff like arguing there's just not enough evidence. That's a very hard appeal to ever win. But it'll be brought up because one of the things that you want to do on appeal typically is every conceivable thing that you can make a good faith argument about, you want to bring it up in the appeal, because if you don't and something happens years down the line and you want to bring it up, a lot of times the appellate court will say you can't because you should have brought it up the first time that you knew about it. And that kind of gets into the piece with the Rodney Reed situation and, you know, why the appellate court potentially was not going to order that the murder weapon be tested, because in his case, it was never tested for DNA. They had swabbed the victim and found Reed's DNA because, according to Reed, they had had a consensual relationship, but they never tested the murder weapon. And they didn't test it even after someone else had confessed, and they didn't test it even after the state's witnesses had recanted. And all this stuff has happened in his case, but the weapon was never tested for DNA to see if he ever actually touched it, which would be a pretty important thing to look into.
We have had executions, as I recall. I can't specify them, but I remember we've had executions where it went to appeal. They had new evidence, or they said they did. And the appeals court said, hey, it's not our job to retry your case. You have a legal conviction. Sorry about that. Which, of course, to any normal layperson is like, seriously, you're going to kill this guy even though he might have mitigating evidence? And it's like, yeah, sometimes they just won't hear it because it doesn't fit into the appeals pattern.
Correct. And one thing that I want your listeners to understand is that law evolves over time, and the law that we inherited from Great Britain and was in place for most of the country's existence was very unfavorable to criminal defendants. There actually is no federal right to appeal a criminal conviction. Mm. And for most of the country's life, we have not had appeals in criminal cases. That was a relatively new thing within the past, 150 years or so. So if a state gives you a right, either via statute or its state constitution, or Congress has put in place a statute with a right of appeal, those procedures have to abide by the Constitution. You have to follow the Due Process Clause in the Fifth Amendment governing procedure and then the 14th Amendment regarding substantive due process. But there is no fundamental constitutional right to appeal a criminal verdict.
And this is where I just want to say, this is where it gets really, really important about who gets nominated and approved by the Senate as federal judges. Because a lot of what we consider our law is really judicial precedent. And what's the term for that? I can never quite pronounce it.
I'm blanking. I really should know, too. Oh, my goodness. This is like, I always refer to it as precedent. I'm not sure which term you're looking
It's something for. Stasis, I think, or something like that.
Oh, stare decisis. Yeah.
Stare decisis. Basically, what's gone before. And it's really amazing, if you dig into it, how much of what we consider law really isn't technically law. It's precedent that has evolved over 240 years that has become accepted process, but isn't actually law, which is why there's so much concern that, for example, the Supreme Court, if it gets very conservative, could literally just ignore precedent and set new precedent that undoes the previous precedent, which basically is like undoing law, which I guess conservatives in some sense might approve of. Some conservatives, they feel judicial lawmaking is inappropriate. I mean, that's a whole other discussion, but yeah, essentially what you're saying is that the process that people go through, the criminal process or even just non-criminal, it evolves over the last couple of centuries in ways that nobody could have predicted, that specific instances sort of demand a consideration of.
Right. And because of the fact that you did not have any criminal appeals for most of the country's existence, you'll occasionally see judicial rulings that are like, look, if you have not followed this appellate process to a T, you filed something late or you're missing a given piece of paperwork or what have you, we're fine denying this appeal. We'll let you be executed without ever testing the evidence because you're never supposed to have this right anyway. Congress just kind of gave it to you by a statute and you didn't do any what you're supposed to do with it. Mm. So you see these really, what we would say is brutal opinions, that just shock our own conscience now. It would have been totally normal back in the 1960s or 1970s. So you got to keep that in mind, that we are starting from a baseline that is very hostile to criminal defendants.
And that's really recent. Almost 200 years after the Constitution. And now, first in the 1960s and 70s, it's begun to give a little more balance to the accused side.
Correct. And it's something where the founders, when they were setting things up, they were very anti-prosecution. If you look at the Bill of Rights and most of the stuff in the Bill of Rights, the majority of the rights that are mentioned make it harder to arrest, make it harder to prosecute, make it harder to punish. And the assumption when they did that was that the trial process would be good enough, that people would go ahead and have the protections from the Bill of Rights, that if there was a guilty verdict at trial, that's because that actually was supposed to be the just result. And, of course, that never took into account the fact that, race plays a tremendous factor in the criminal justice system. Money, whether or not you have a lawyer, how good your lawyer is, plays a tremendous role. So all this stuff they never accounted for. Judges tended to just ignore for, first 200 years. Mm. And then in the 60s and 70s, you had the Warren Court, where they really just started realizing this stuff is ridiculous. Like, it used to be legal that police could beat you until you confessed.
Just watch the old noir movies.
Right. And you would see mugshots where people have a black eye or a busted lip, what have you, and then all of a sudden they confess to the crime, and they couldn't appeal it because a lot of times when you end up confessing to something and then pleading guilty to it, you waive your appeal right. Mm. And then what the Warren Court said was, you know, that's improper. You're violating someone's Fifth Amendment right not to testify against themselves when you've got them in custody without a lawyer and you're beating them until they give you what you want. So throughout the 60s, 70s, early 80s, you had this swing heavily in favor of dissent, where even though it swung in their favor, you still had a bunch of people being prosecuted because things had started so, you know, defense hostile from the beginning. And then you had throughout the 80s and 90s and the war on drugs and everything else, and then the war on terrorism in the early 2000s, things aggressively and almost absurdly swung back in the other direction where, you know, convicting somebody is super easy nowadays, still is. And then really it's been within the past 8 to 9 years that people realize you're warehousing millions of Americans. You know, I saw a study out about 5-6 months ago where it's estimated that 1 in 2, so 50% of the country, has a family member who's been incarcerated at some point.
Yeah, that's unbelievable.
We lock up more people than anywhere else in the modern world.
I mean, that almost looks by definition like a classic oppressive government.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Let me do
a
quick
station.
That's
the type of stuff that conservatives dislike.
Let me do a quick station ID. You're listening to KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. This is Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig. My guest is T. Greg Doucette. He's an attorney in Durham, North Carolina, who focuses on criminal defense and constitutional law. He is a political conservative, but a former Republican. And he hosts the podcast, Fisk 'Em All. Don't ask. Just go to my website, thinkwingradio.com, and click on the link that I found, where he focuses on the weak stories involving misconduct by police, prosecutors, judges, and politicians. And that's why I love the guy. So let's get a little bit now. I'm hoping we'll have time for maybe a couple of phone calls if people decide to call in with questions or comments. But I want to get into the Rodney Reed case details. Just briefly, the trial and conviction, the appeal, the grounds for appeal, and why it really was so shocking that the appeals court did actually send it back down to the lower court for evidence testing. I mean, that's rare.
Mm-hmm. So as far as the initial trial goes, he was tried back in 1996. There was a 19-year-old girl named Stacy Stites who was killed. She was actually abducted, raped, and murdered. And the police focused on Reed because, one, he had been suspected in several other attacks. It turns out, in hindsight, he was never charged in 5 of them. They did charge him in the 6th, but the jury acquitted him. But he did have a relationship with the girl that had been intimate at some point fairly recently. His DNA was on her, and that was good enough for him to be arrested and prosecuted. And there were a few pieces relating to his trial that folks are looking back and saying, well, wait a minute, that's not proper. One, of course, is he was black and his jury was all white. And we've seen that happen throughout the South, you know, throughout other states as well, but it's very predominantly in the Deep South, that you have this racial mismatch between the defendant and the jury that leads to people being convicted even though the evidence doesn't support it. As we mentioned earlier, the murder weapon was never tested for DNA, still has not been tested to this date. Several of the states' expert witnesses, the medical examiner and a few others, later retracted their testimony, saying that the time of death for Ms. Stites was actually different than what they had said in court. And that mattered because if she was murdered before she went to work, that gives you a different set of suspects than if she was murdered after she went to work, which is what the state had claimed. Back in 2007, another man who had actually been mentioned by Rodney Reed as the guy who did it, actually confessed to killing her, but then he was in prison at the time already, and he's since been released and is off living on his own. So that has been just kind of ignored. And then there are also allegations that the prosecution team withheld some of that evidence that would have exonerated Rodney Reed, you know, never turned that over to the defense.
Now, that's automatically grounds for a retrial.
Correct. There's a Supreme Court case called Brady versus Maryland. It says that if the state has any evidence that tends to exculpate you, tends to suggest you did not do the particular crime, the prosecution is required to turn it over to the defense. They can still prosecute you. They can still get a guilty verdict. But they have to at least give you that evidence so you know what it is you're dealing with. If they hide it from you, you get a new trial. So what happened, and again, part of this is Texas specific, so I don't want to get too far out over my skis on the procedure. But you have both the Court of Criminal Appeals that is dealing with the appellate issues, and then you have the Texas Parole Board. And essentially, Reed's attorney is pointing out some of this stuff. He's already had an appeal before on at least some of it, but the attorney is particularly focused this time on the recanting of the witnesses and the fact the murder weapon was never tested, and saying, look, at the very least, just test it before you kill him. You know, if you want to go ahead and kill him afterwards, fine, but at least test it so we know for sure. And there's been enough other cases where people have been exonerated by DNA evidence that now folks are willing to hear that they may not have been before. You know, DNA testing is now so advanced that I can swab my cheek and send it to 23andMe and they'll give you my gene profile. So it's incredibly easy for
and
the
yet,
government.
I was just going to say, and yet, up until certainly this point, it has been very rare for an appeals court to really look at that extraneous stuff. It has to be something really egregious, usually, to send it back down to the original trial court.
That's correct. So when you're on appeal, and I don't want to get too deep in the weeds on the law stuff, but essentially the Court of Appeals is going to apply a certain standard, we call them standards of review, to address different things that they have to consider. So if they're considering a legal question, strictly on the law, you know, how do I interpret this particular federal statute? The review is what's called de novo. They do it from scratch. They don't pay any attention to what the trial judge said. If they're dealing with rulings that happen during the trial, so a defense attorney objects to evidence coming in and the prosecution says, no, we want it, and the judge says, okay, prosecution, you win. The appellate court is going to use what is called an abuse of discretion standard, which means that if the judge's ruling was one of a broad range of options that were allowed, the appeals court will have to affirm it even if they would think of it some differently. You know, we say that they can't overturn it unless there was discretion exercised to an end that was not justified by the evidence. So de novo, no deference, abuse of discretion, a little bit of deference. Then you get into the jury's verdict and rulings on what are called findings of fact, and those are very deferential. And the reason why is that when the appellate court is looking at the case, all they're getting is that record that we talked about earlier, that multi-thousand-page transcript. They're not seeing people live. They're not able to gauge their mannerisms or how they talk or what they say. They're only looking at a black-and-white piece of paper. So what these rulings deal with
is basically writing without emojis, so you can't even convey a little bit of what your intent is and whether you're being sarcastic or funny.
Exactly, exactly. And so because of that, we have these very deferential standards that is called the clearly erroneous standard is one, and then the substantial evidence standard is another, and they're both kind of intertwined. And basically, if there is evidence in the record that reasonable minds could accept as being adequate to support a conclusion, even if you would disagree with it, if you could accept it as adequate to support the conclusion, the appeals court has to affirm the jury's verdict, even if they disagree with it.
Which seems on its face to a layperson ridiculous, and yet.
Agreed. That's absolutely. But it's something where you're trying to avoid chronic do-overs of criminal trials. The assumption is that if you have a less deferential standard, if you use, you know, abuse of discretion or de novo, everybody who was ever convicted of a crime is going to appeal and then expect the Court of Appeals to do a trial all over again.
Mm.
You know, we have a saying that appeals are not do-overs.
Right.
You're looking for specific errors based on a specific record that is in place. So in Rodney Reed's case, for example, I mean, he's been in prison now for, I think, 23 years.
Yeah.
Some of that stuff that has been raised before was denied. I mean, he had an initial appeal after his verdict, and that verdict was affirmed. The court said, no, we're not going to undo this. You still have to stay in prison. But it's this new stuff. You know, the notion that you haven't tested a weapon when it's cheap and easy and quick to do so is just so glaring that it triggered a lot of public scrutiny. You had a lot of, you know, lay people in Texas and nationally looking at it. Several celebrities got involved in
it. When Ted Cruz says that I think the court is wrong, that's already saying something.
Right, exactly. So you have the Court of Criminal Appeals say, look, you know, delay his execution for now to at least test this and see what happens. We're not undoing the verdict, but we're at least going to say, take another look at it. And then separately, you had the parole board taking all these phone calls from the public and everything else to the point where they had a specific page on their website with instructions for people calling relating to Rodney Reed, the parole board unanimously recommended that they hold off for 4 months to give the state that time to test the murder weapon and everything else.
So now his execution has been stayed for 120 days in order to give the court a chance to see DNA results and whatever else they're appealing. Now, I think a fundamental question, and let me do a quick station ID. You're listening to KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. This is Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig. And my guest is the ever-interesting T. Greg Doucette, an attorney in Durham, North Carolina, focusing on criminal defense and constitutional law. He is a political conservative and reformed Republican. He hosts the podcast Fisk 'Em All. Go to my website, thinkwingradio.com. Click on the link because it's too complicated, where he focuses on the weak stories involving misconduct by police, prosecutors, judges, and politicians. What I love about Greg is, political differences aside, he is interested in justice. There's law and there's justice. And to me, in his line of work, what I love about him is he takes his justice seriously. So that's why he's on the show, and that's why I got a guy from North Carolina instead of Texas. So what I understand is, precedent, this was once explained to me, and I guess I'm a little clear on it. Precedent is really what the Supreme Court says. When something like a district court or an appeals court makes a decision, there's a different term for it. It's not precisely precedent. It's guidance, I think, is the term.
We call it persuasive authority as opposed to binding authority.
Okay. So now with the decision that's been made for Rodney Reed, which is fairly atypical, has there been any kind of, what you called it, persuasive
authority?
Yeah. Has this now changed how other appeals courts might view things because of the way this was handled and decided?
The short answer is it's hard to know, and it really depends on who the judges are. So one of the things that you'll often find with judicial nominees and people that are already on the bench is that they have a tendency to find the outcome they want first and then reverse engineer how to get there.
Sounds a lot like Judge Judy. I hate Judge Judy.
And it's really something that hinges on, you know, the words that they play with. So, for example, if other judges want to use the Rodney Reed case as a reason to get more DNA testing, what they'll say is, look, this guy is, you know, was in jail for 23 years. Another guy confessed. There's reason to believe he didn't do it. It's cheap, quick, and easy to get it done. And they'll cite that and say, this is persuasive to us. If, on the other hand, a judge did not want to use the Rodney Reed case, what he'll say instead is, well, this particular guy was in jail for 23 years. He was convicted by a jury because of the fact his DNA was found on the victim. Yes, the murder weapon wasn't tested, but it wasn't needed because you had these people testify that she died at this particular time and date. And they'll highlight the reasons why the verdict should have been upheld in the first place.
That would be from the prosecutorial side.
Correct. And they'll use that to avoid relying on the case as persuasive authority or not. So you very rarely see courts uniformly take a position. You know, for example, one of the things we look at...
It kind of goes into the mental judicial cloud, though.
Right, right. And it's something that's all going to be indexed online anyway. So clerks who work for judges, law students, law professors, they all use the same databases of court opinions. You know, Lexis, Westlaw, Fastcase, all those folks. And once the case is in there, it's going to be there for other people to look at in the future. And occasionally you get compilations that become pretty compelling to new judges who hear the case. You know, a key example I give folks is whether or not you have a First Amendment right to record police. You've had six different federal circuits consider that question over the course of 20 years. And by sheer coincidence, all six of them had said yes. Mm. Well, if you live in a circuit that has not yet considered that, technically it's not binding precedent on you because the Supreme Court has not weighed in. But when you give a judge a sheet of paper that has six different circuits, each with a court decision, each coming at the exact same result, there's a pretty high likelihood that the judge you're talking to is going to do the same, because mm-hmm. they don't want to get overturned either. It's embarrassing to them.
Right.
And they're going to read those opinions and assume that since everyone else agrees, they're going to agree too. But a lot of times you don't have that level of uniformity. So I'll give you a counterexample, the notion of what are called anti-SLAPP statutes. If your folks watched Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, they got a brief primer on SLAPP suits.
It's really a necessity for the news-oriented person. It's important education with funny.
Right, exactly. Whether or not those are constitutional, you know, the Ninth Circuit, which is California, has said yes. The First Circuit has said yes. But the D.C. Circuit has said no. The Fifth Circuit, which includes Texas, has said no. So you've got this split down the middle. So any new circuit that considers it, whether they're going to agree or disagree, is going to depend on the political leanings of the judges.
I think at this point, we've pretty much covered the topic. I mean, we could go into some other stuff, but I think we're at a stage now where if there's anybody out there who wants to make a comment or ask a question on what we've discussed so far, we have about 10 minutes. The number is 713-526-5738, 713-526-5738. We do want to stay more or less on topic, so please don't call like for small claims court legal advice. Did you have a chance to read the article on Norway that I sent you, or at least scan some of the high points?
I did. I read the whole thing.
What are your thoughts on that? I mean, that's a totally counterintuitive process, and yet, at least in Norway, they feel it is working.
Right. It's so hard to try and convince people to try it here to ever get to a point where we can see the results of whether it worked or not. You know, even basic stuff as far as how police orient themselves to the community. You know, you look at England. England does not have a Norwegian-style prison system. That's more American-style in terms of how they deal with inmates. But their police tend to be unarmed, at least as far as guns go. I mean, they'll have tasers, they'll have batons.
Lethal weapons they don't carry typically.
Right. Exactly. And what you see as a result is that their police tend to value the sanctity of life more than American police do. And the court system there tends to frown upon killing people in a way that the American court system does not. I mean, if you're an officer here, there's a million different excuses you can use to execute somebody, and you're probably not going to be criminally prosecuted.
And we're talking about executing on the street. We're not talking about executing after due process.
Correct. You know, you're unlikely to be charged if you do it, and if you get sued, you'll get qualified immunity that will protect you from having to owe any money to the family.
Mm.
You know, it's just something that the European countries don't have, and, you know, they used to, but they've tried to get away from it, and their different approach works. I mean, you have lower recidivism, you have more trust in the entity itself.
Even the UK has abolished capital punishment, and we're, you know, cousins, identical cousins, as they say.
Exactly. So, going back to the Norwegian article, I like the results. I just don't see how it could ever politically get passed here, because you've got states, you know, I hate to say it, Texas is a good example, where this notion of trying to rehabilitate inmates gets seen as being too sissified, if you will. There's not enough punishment involved. We want to be macho and beat them into submission.
You know,
what they should be doing is making them productive citizens for when they get released.
One of the quotes that I use a lot on the show comes from a radio host that I loved in the 1970s, David Fowler. And he once made a comment I have remembered, I guess, for the last 40 years. And the question is, do we send people to prison as punishment, or do we send people to prison for punishment? Those are two very different things, and they are philosophically importantly distinct.
Right. I agree.
Okay, the phone number, we have several minutes if somebody wants to call in with a comment or question. Otherwise, I'm being told maybe 1 minute. Hold on. I have Andrew gesturing at me.
We've just gotten a caller is what I'm trying to tell you.
Oh.
We've just gotten somebody on.
Okay. Who is it? Do we have a name?
Oh, I'm sorry. They seem to have dropped. Hey, if that was you, call back, because we'd love to have you, and I'm sure our guest would love to try and answer any of your questions.
Well,
I mean,
the point of this particular show is to answer questions from last week's show, and I'm kind of hoping that if people out there interested in this topic feel that there's something they would like clarified or explained or to comment on, this is the time. We've got the guy online, 713-526-5738. I see a line blinking. So we're going to try to get somebody on. As it happens, it's Mike, the ninth most common name in America. Mike, you are, I think, on.
Okay, and what's even more common is the name Smith, which is my last name.
I'm sorry.
And I'm just here to represent all the Smiths, like Rourke Smith in the morning.
Okay.
Because, you know, once upon a time, you know, back in the days of the Garden of Eden, everybody was named Smith, and all the people who screwed up got tossed out and had to change their name.
Yeah, so sorry about that. All right, let's kind of
okay,
stick
listen,
to the topic.
You know, I got some unique perspective here because, for one thing, 30-odd years ago, I ran a legal supply outfit, and I got to know a whole bunch of lawyers, and then shortly after I left there, I became a target of HPD and Houston prosecutors because I committed a crime back in the 70s, and I went to jail for it. I could have gotten probation, but I took the jail time to spare my partner so that he could get the probation. Well, that was all said and done. Then I worked my way through legal channels. I learned everything I could in the law library the little time I was in there. And I got out, and I worked my way up in the graphic arts industry until I got a job at a legal supply outfit, and I worked my way up to the plant manager and the seeds.
Okay, I'm going to need you to consolidate this down because I think we've got several other people.
Anyway, in 85, HPD targeted me, locked me up, and in 95, I managed to target them and get the laws changed so that all ex-convicts got their voting rights back, because that's what I was after. But what I'm here to ask y'all about is to comment on the fact that we're living in a confederacy now and the rule of law doesn't apply.
I'm sorry, did that come over the air?
I don't know.
Greg, are you still with us, or can Greg not hear us anymore?
We can only have one person on the line at a time.
Okay, but can Greg hear what's going on?
I'm not sure whether he can hear what's going on.
But he can't respond.
He certainly can't respond.
Mike, I'm going to ask you to wrap up your story and Greg respond.
Basically, I wanted to ask y'all what y'all think, because in my opinion, right now we're living in the Confederacy. It started with Rush Limbaugh trying to get everybody hyped up, and then it came on with the Mitch McConnell spiking the courts, spicing the courts and everything. And now it's gotten to the point where there is no rule of law because the president is no longer president. He's a dictator. If the Democrats don't go to the courts to force him to turn over all the stuff that they did back in the Nixon days, then he goes on to an election that he can then fix through all his entities.
Okay, Mike, I know you have a story to tell, and I'm going to have
to
ask you.
Well, that's what I
want to
know. Well, okay. How come we're living in a confederacy and nobody's talking about it?
Okay, that's a question. Thank you so much. Take care. All right, Greg, are you with us?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes. Could you hear the caller? Basically, the question when he wrapped it all up was, why are we living back in the Confederacy? Do you agree, disagree?
I heard him talking. So the issue is there's layers to it. You know, one of the ways you can ensure the laws apply as they're supposed to is to pay close attention to your prosecutor's elections, because in most states and most districts, the prosecutors are actually elected officials.
Elections matter. They have consequences.
Absolutely. And not only that, they're low turnout elections most of the time, so it's easier for you to go ahead and change who your prosecutor is than it is for you to change your senator or your president. So your prosecution elections, your sheriff's elections, and then also, frankly, your legislators.
That's why at the beginning of every show, I spend several minutes talking about voting and elections and registration for precisely that reason. I'm going to try to get another caller on. Adrian, I believe, is next in line. So,
hey, good afternoon.
Hey.
Thank you for taking the call.
Now, keep in mind, Greg cannot respond to you directly. So if you would pose a question or make a statement and then hang up so Greg can talk.
Certainly. I'm just hoping that everyone out there will impress upon their elected leaders the need to eliminate qualified immunity and make bad police accountable for their actions. The botched drug raid on Harding Street should be a classic example. And also to remind your listeners, cops lie, cameras don't. Always record interaction with police.
Okay, hold on one second. Okay, thank you very much, Adrian. I'm told Greg was not able to hear Adrian. Okay, Greg, are you back with me?
Put him back on the air.
Yeah, as you can tell, we're having some computer issues we're working through. Are you there, Greg?
I'm here now. Can you
okay,
hear me?
Yeah. Adrian was talking about things like... I'm sorry, Andrew. Help me sum up. Adrian, because I was sort of distracted, Adrian was talking about things like body cams and...
Yes. Adrian was basically saying that it's important to keep our police accountable,
right,
to understand that that the people who are in our institutions uniformly good, and we've got to make sure that when those bad people get into those institutions,
they shouldn't always get
do.
The benefit of the doubt. Cops should not always get the benefit of the doubt. Sometimes they've actually done something wrong.
Correct. And I would say more than sometimes. I have an entire podcast where all of my material every week is just new stories.
Yeah, go to my website so you can find the link to it.
So I would say body cams are incredibly important. More than that, citizen cams, using your cell phone to record. I tell people record everything because in a lot of states, the body camera footage is reviewed by the police first. And if stuff disappears, that happens often. You know, there have been times where the body cam footage has been accidentally, and I'm putting that in air quotes, erased. There was one where someone had placed a magnet on top of the media that it was used to record on, so you ended up with this blurry stuff, like old school antenna TVs not coming in right.
Now, one of the things that I want to verify with you is that it is now established law that as long as you do not interfere with police in their function, you're allowed to record anything in public.
Only in the odd-numbered federal circuits. So the first third—I promise you—it's only happenstance that it happened this way. But the first third, fifth, seventh, ninth, and 11th.
Third. What are we in Texas?
You're in the fifth, so it's legal there. But I'm in the fourth, so we actually have not—you know—the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit has not considered that yet. So North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, South Carolina. We don't know. I mean, like I said, it will likely end up as the same result because those six other circuits have already agreed. But you could have a judge here that decides they want to be persnickety and just say no.
Okay. Andrew, do we have time for James? Because my clock in here doesn't work and my watch is only approximate.
We've got a minute left. So...
Okay. All right. Let's try. James, and let's try to keep Greg on the line this time so he can at least hear. James, are you on?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right. Short time, so be succinct.
Okay. I appreciate your guest knowledge and of the law, and I respect that. My question is, he used Texas as an example of how he would wish that the law would be represented. My question is to him is, I want to understand his mindset because he serves a party, being a conservative Republican, that is quickly...
Well, he's no longer a Republican, so he doesn't serve that party.
They quickly weaponize the law.
Okay, so, I'm going to have to let you go, James, because we're really down to seconds. Greg, can you respond in like 10 seconds or less?
Well, I don't think I want everyone to be like Texas. I'm just pointing out that Texas is very different from everyone else.
And I want to point out that you don't serve the Republicans. You are an ex-Republican. Who endorsed Elizabeth Warren. So let's get the record straight. Greg, I appreciate you so much, and I appreciate your taking the time. I think you've been very educational, very informative on this very important issue. We'll be back next week, Monday, 3 p.m., and we'll probably have Greg back at some point because there's stuff going on. Okay, Greg, take care. I appreciate you again. Take care. And everybody have a great week. Bye-bye.
Did you just look down at your phone? You did it again, didn't you? You know, you're flying down the road in a 3-ton hunk of steel, and a text takes your eyes off the road for an average of 5 seconds. At 55 miles per hour, that's long enough to travel the length of a football field and cause some serious damage. Turn it off. Trust me, whatever it is, you'll live. Learn more at stoptextsstoprex.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. KPFT Houston.
Where freedom rings and singers sing. Where Robert Earl Keen meets Martin Luther King. From jazz, justice, peace, and rap. R&B, sports,